Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll, welcoming you to Bantercast, the latest podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. We've heard a lot about 1916 this year, so it struck us as a good idea to find out what Irish farmers were up to 100 years ago as things took an unexpected turn that Easter in Dublin. We were joined by Dr. Arlene Crampsey from UCD School of Geography at the Bloom Festival in the Phoenix Park to discuss the state of the land 100 years ago and the difficulties and challenges which Irish farmers faced. Okay, hi folks, welcome along, welcome back to Banter here at Bloom. If you're listening on the podcast, thank you very much for tuning in. We're joined this morning by Dr. Arlene Crampsey from the UCD School of Geography. Good morning, can I call you Arlene or Doctor?
Oh God, you better call me Arlene.
Arlene.
I don't really answer to Doctor. I think I've done something wrong.
So give us a little bit about your background. Before we start talking about like the state of farming nation in 1916, give us something about your own background.
Okay, well, I'm a historical geographer based out in UCD, and I suppose my kind of research interests are 19th, early 20th century Ireland and Irish historical geographies. And my main research focus was local government in rural areas. That's what I did my PhD on. And then I spent a while working on a project on the GAA, travelling around the country, collecting oral histories. So basically talking to people about their life and times in the GAA.
Yeah.
And then I've moved on to this kind of looking at what's happening in the political arena, but at a local area. So taking it away from national politics to local politics.
Okay, right. So when you got a call from me asking you to come along to speak at Banter at Bloom about farm life in 1916, what was your first reaction?
Help. And also, this person sounds more enthusiastic about my research than my students do, so that should be good.
Okay. Well, the reason for the enthusiasm has to do with, like, I mean, we've heard an awful lot this year about 1916, about, like, I mean, what happened in terms of GPO and what was kind of like the state of the political nation at that point. And because Bloom is sort of like, I mean, such a kind of a festival about, like, obviously about gardens, it's about food, but it's also a farming festival as well. I was just curious about, like, I mean, what was the lay of the land back in 1916 on the farms? I mean, at that stage, what was the average farm size like, Arlene?
Well, I suppose there's no such thing really as the average Irish farm when we're looking at the early 20th century. We're really looking at, depending on where in the country you are, very different styles of farming and types of farming in those locations. If you think about it, there's a huge number of people, something to the tune of about 600,000 people living on holdings that are valued at less than £4.
So less than £4. So that would be like, that would be small farmers, right?
Yeah, that's your proper small farming areas. Two-thirds of all farmers are in farms of less than 30 acres. So we're looking at that kind of real small farm zone. And then at the upper extreme, we've got the much larger farms with very small percentages of the farming population. There's 2.5 million people in Ireland in 1911 from the 1911 census living on farms. So that's 57% of the total population in the country living in farms or farm households. And there's quite a geography to that. You can see a concentration in the more rural areas where you'd expect it, in Donegal along the west coast, and then more urban areas with smaller percentages, places like Antrim and Down, Dublin and Cork.
Let's kind of talk a little bit about like those subsistence farmers, so those small farmers. You know, like what would their kind of like mean? What are they? Are they kind of like, are they tillage farmers? Are they keeping a couple of cattle, or is it mixed farms?
Tends in the very small farm areas, it tends to be subsistence farming. So it's a mix of farming. You've got, you know, the acre of potatoes to feed the family. You've got some oats and corn being grown to feed the couple of cows that they might have, a few sheep. So it tends to be a mixture of just enough to keep the family going, and then if there is a surplus, then they'll sell that on. So that small farm zone really stretches right the way along the west coast of Ireland, from Donegal down to Cork, but also in upland regions and in, I suppose, the waste ground that you'd consider around the Midlands, and the higher level ground. So along anywhere that you've got mountainous regions, you'd have that kind of subsistence level farming.
Right. So that's really interesting, because I mean, if you look at kind of like a sort of sweep of Irish farming today, that, like, obviously along the west coast, it's still small farms by nature of kind of like, you know, the land and by nature of history as well. I'm curious though about the Midlands. You said there, like, you know, there was still a kind
kind of a swathe of kind of like, I mean, smaller farms there. Today, when we look at the Midlands, we see bigger farms, we see ranches, we see like large holdings. Like, what was there, was that kind of evident at that case? Was the landlord class that we'd have known, was that their kind of like, I mean, was that their hood? Was that where they were hanging out?
Yeah, pretty much. So once you start looking at the pattern of the types of farmers, from the East Coast right the way across the Midlands and across to Galway, you can essentially draw a line from Meath and North Dublin right the way across into Connacht, where you've got the grazier lands, and that's the rich, fertile, limestone-based grasslands, large field sizes, and very few people. So an awful lot of cows, very little people, and the people that are there tend to be on the small holdings surrounding that, trying to eke out a living on the worst ground. And the big problem in the early 20th century, or one of the things that I suppose gets people's political backs up, is the fact that there is all of these people in these really small holdings, really poor, trying to eke out an existence. And at the same time, you've got these massive farmers with maybe one herd or one herd and his family living on the property, not contributing anything to the local economy and taking huge chunks of profit off the best of the grassland.
Yeah.
But they're not necessarily the landlords. So what we often see are the landlords owning the ground and renting to these graziers on an 11-month system. And that causes all kinds of political chaos during the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah.
We tend to think about land agitation as happening in the land war in the kind of 1880s, early 1890s. But from about 1903, 1904 up to 1909, 1910, there's a ranch war, and it's directed at these graziers trying to force them to sell off their properties, essentially driving cattle off the land. You know, you've got local groups that are politically active, involved in an organisation called the United Irish League. And those represent farmers, farmer sons, labourers, and they use peaceful methods. So they'll hold public meetings on the grazier's land. They'll beat drums. They'll shoot pistols sometimes as kind of this kind of a threat or a symbol of their threat on these lands, and basically try and intimidate the person to sell off their property to the tenants and then have it redistributed among the people in the local community.
And was this successful? Were these campaigns successful?
Hugely successful, because there's a real political mobilisation at the local level in this period. Something to the tune of about 10% of the adult male population are involved in political organisations in Ireland in the run-up to 1916. And a lot of them are involved in these agricultural movements. And they're only successful because there is buy-in. So if you think about the boycotting campaign that Charles Stewart Parnell made famous, they reinvigorate that in the early 20th century in the run-up to the First World War. And it's essentially saying, OK, you're not going to sell your land to us for redistribution, so we're not going to engage with you. Your herd, if you have a herd to herd your cattle, will have his house or property attacked. And this is where we get the slightly less political means coming in. You might have your haystack burnt. We might drive your cattle off your land if you're lucky. If you're unlucky, we might chop the legs off a couple of cattle. And there's an awful lot of attacks and injuries to animals in this period. But then the wider community get involved. So people won't work for them. People won't come in to harvest whatever crops that they have. They won't get served in the shops. So it becomes essentially this isolation of these individuals. And they can't eke out an existence in the Irish countryside anymore. So it's really successful in forcing them to sell. And eventually they do negotiate and find ways of selling off a portion of their land and keeping a portion, or selling the whole thing and just saying, I can't handle this anymore.
Did some people who were involved in this campaign, did some people involved in the United Land League, did they end up kind of like being involved with the volunteers, being involved with like the War of Independence?
Yeah, so I suppose when we start thinking about the political thing, we think that, you know, the land war happens and then the political activity happens, but there's a huge interaction between the two of them and feed in between both. So what we see, if you look at the political map of Ireland in early 1914, you've got serious land agitation still happening in Galway and Clare, and to a lesser extent in counties like Mayo and Sligo, and Tipperary, Offaly and Laois. And then you've got the Ulster Volunteers and the Irish Volunteers starting to become active in Ulster. So we've got these two different campaigns happening at the same time. And we get a huge buy-in to the Irish Volunteers from the United Irish League, particularly along the West Coast. And that feeds membership into the Irish Volunteers. So they kind of use it as another vehicle to get their land issue sorted, I suppose.
Yeah.
Whereas in Ulster, it's very much more focused on the political situation, home rule versus unionism, and the dynamic that's going on up there.
Okay, brilliant. So, I mean, while this agitation will help, like, you know, suppose smallholders and, like, farmers secure the land and get rid of the grazier class, you know, at the same time, like, every farmer knows that agitation alone doesn't butter any parsnips. They still need to make some money and they still need to eke out a living. Go back to something you said earlier on, Arlene. You kind of said there might be a surplus left over in terms of some subsistence farmers. Where would they sell that surplus? And, like, you know, today for farmers, obviously Europe is a huge issue. Well, did Europe matter a toss to farmers back in 1916?
Hugely. And I suppose when we look at Irish history and how we talk about things, we tend to think about Ireland as this little island that's off on its own, that doesn't really engage with anything else. But Ireland throughout the 19th century into the 20th century is hugely impacted by what's going on in Europe. Anytime there's a war in Europe of any description, prices go up in Ireland. On the eve of the famine, Ireland's the breadbasket of Britain. You know, we've got the sense that Ireland's an impoverished country before the famine. It can't support its own people. It's supporting the entire industrial population of England. 66% of all exports into Britain before the famine are coming from corn from Ireland. And that continues right through into the early 20th century. So depending on how the market's doing abroad, it has a huge impact on what prices people are getting for their goods that they're producing here. Now, that doesn't necessarily impact on the small farmers in the West Coast. They'll get slightly better prices, but they'll sell their goods at local fairs and markets. They'll be bought by other people and transferred. And we've got this movement from west to east that we see happening, and then export, and sometimes from west to the south as well. Cork's obviously still an important port in that period.
Okay, cool. So that's kind of like, I mean, the political situation dealt with. That's sort of like, you know, the market situation dealt with. There was also, you talked as well to me before about, like, I mean, the regulation side of things. You know, like, you know, today, obviously, farmers kind of like, I mean, look at the list of regulations they have to have. That used to be for reps and now it's for gloss. There's a whole kind of situation with the Department of Agriculture inspectors. The farmers are very well versed in regulations. We often think back to kind of like 100 years ago, and maybe we're thinking that things were a bit more loosey-goosey back then. Not the case?
Absolutely not the case. I suppose this is one of the big revelations that I found. I mean, I come from a small farm in Donegal, and we're forever given out about all these new regulations and all the paperwork and how are we going to fill in the different registers and the sheep and, oh God, help us all. And you think that that was a day when there was none of that intervention, but actually in the early part of the 20th century, there was a huge level of intervention. And it's driven by a need to improve public health and sanitation conditions, not just in Ireland, but in the industrial areas in England. So there's a focus on food supply. And because there's a focus on improving food supply and food hygiene, there's a focus on where that food's coming from and a focus on the farms. So what we see from the 1870s onwards is an increase in legislation around public health and sanitation that directly impacts on small farms across Ireland. And that becomes more pronounced once there's a new form of local government introduced called rural district councils. So everybody's probably familiar with the town councils that were abolished a couple of years ago, but there were these rural councils. And essentially they employed people to inspect every farm in Ireland on a weekly basis to see that they were standing up to these types of legislation about hygiene standards, particularly in terms of milk production and provision. And animal welfare becomes an issue. So from the very early point, the state's getting involved in local households and how they're running their operation. So, for example, it would have been common practice in small farming areas to keep animals in houses with people. That's one of the things that happened. And they outlaw this practice because they're saying this is not sanitary practice. People are getting diseases from the animals, but also how can the food that's being produced in these farms be helpful? So the animals are essentially evicted from the houses and farmers have to build byres and sheds for them. And then they look at kind of, I suppose, the traditional relationships around different farming communities where one person who had several cows would supply milk to their neighbours. And they're saying, okay, you're not selling milk, but you're still providing it. And if you're not doing it in the right way, well, you can be passing on diseases to the consumer. So even if you're not getting money for the milk you're supplying, we want to regulate your milk supply. So from 1908 onwards, it's compulsory to have your byres and sheds inspected by these inspectors. And they check out things like the level of ventilation that the cattle have in the sheds. They check out the cleanliness of the equipment that's producing the milk. They make sure that it's being created to a certain standard. And that drives changes and improvements in the quality of milk, and it has a huge knock-on impact on infectious diseases. So there's one disease in particular, enteric fever, that's common and transmitted through essentially the milk supply. And cases of that decrease by a half in a 10-year period once this legislation's introduced. So it becomes really successful in improving that quality. But you also get people suddenly realising, hold on, we have to do this. And the level of bureaucracy increases. They have to be registered for these different dairies and creameries. And then we get the growth of the industrialised milk production as well in this period. So from the 1880s onwards, we see creameries beginning to appear.
And co-ops.
Yeah. Co-ops, yeah, exactly, and spreading across the country, and they demand a higher standard of regulation
as
well.
Excellent. And also, I'm kind of thinking as well, as you're talking there about like the need to build cow sheds outside buildings for cattle to get away from that punch caricature of the pigs and cattle living in the Irish home. There's also kind of strikes me, is that when we begin to see as well a situation where small farmers begin to take on outside jobs, like in terms of like mean construction maybe and stuff like that?
Yeah, there's certainly a bit of that, and it depends again where in the country you are and what size of a farm you're on. We certainly see a huge amount of seasonal migration in this period, particularly from, again, the counties along the west coast, where people move eastwards to help with the harvest, but also that seasonal migration of the tatty hokers to Scotland gathering potatoes, or from Mayo into the Midlands where they help with the beet harvest. So we've got that kind of a transfer of people. So people are essentially getting out of the farming industry for periods of time, bringing money back in and then invest in that on their properties.
And like, I mean, say in terms of another thing, which kind of like, I mean, the farm communities would be very cognizant of, would be migration patterns, long-term migration patterns to the States. Were we seeing kind of like an awful lot of people post-famine going to the States? And do you know roughly when it became a situation where people who migrate to the States would often migrate back as well afterwards, which is something that's never really kind of like referred to that much?
Yeah, it's not something that I've done a huge amount of research on, but I know from talking to other people that on the 1911 census, there's a huge amount of children from the United States recorded living with their grandparents. So what we think is happening, and there's scope for research to be done on this, is people who have gone to the States, either they're too busy working to care for the children, maybe they've been left widowed and become a widower, and the children are sent home and brought up in Ireland while they continue working. But emigration is really a huge factor of Irish life from the famine onwards.
Yeah.
Not to the same extent as it is during the famine period, but it is really significant right up into the 20th century.
Right. And where those migration patterns, Arlene, say from counties like Donegal and Mayo to Scotland, those kind of temporary migration patterns, were they kind of common at that stage as well?
Yeah, they're certainly well established in this period. And what we actually see on the eve of the First World War is lots of people not going off to gather the potatoes in Scotland because they're scared of conscription once the First World War breaks out. So there's reports, the Royal Irish Constabulary report on what's happening in local areas, and they're essentially saying, oh well, a lot of the farming classes aren't migrating this year because they don't want to be conscripted into the army, so they're staying at home or they're emigrating to America. So the war has a huge impact on who turns where and, you know, changes that pattern of where they're looking to in terms of migration as well.
Did many kind of like, I mean, I suppose farm owners, farm labourers kind of sign up to the British Army anyway? I mean, like you talk about like people not going to Scotland for fear of conscription. We know that a lot of people from urban areas, certainly in Ireland, could like join the British Army because of money. Did the same thing happen in terms of kind of like rural life?
It does and it doesn't. So I suppose when we start looking at who signs up voluntarily for the army, you've got that sense that anybody who supports John Redmond and the Irish Volunteers, that they're encouraged to join the war effort. But when you look at who actually signs up first, it's the upper classes who would have those kind of standard family links with the army anyway, and the lower classes, the shop boys, the farm labourers, people who see an opportunity for themselves to make money. And there's really interesting descriptions of what the farmers are at in this period. And essentially the farmers, because the war is on, economic prices are good for the goods that are being produced. There's a huge demand for Irish goods to feed the British Army. Prices rise and the farmers are kind of like, well, why would we go off anywhere? So the Royal Irish Constabulary again talk about how the farmers are standing aside in a drift in a selfish and unpatriotic attitude as they're refusing to join this war effort. So you've got the farmers essentially going, nah, we're grand where we are, we're making money, why would we go? And there's these repeated efforts to try and make them understand the seriousness of the situation. Because, you know, the Irish people don't understand how serious it is. And this is the rhetoric that keeps being, I suppose, put out. And you've got these travelling meetings where the army are going around talking about the realities of the war and how the farmers need to conscript. And they're just sitting there going, no.
So even back then, the farmers stood aside?
Yeah. Right, completely. Okay. So they're very politicized, they're very engaged in politics, but they're not heading off to the war effort. Right.
And like, I mean, we know again from kind of like, I suppose, the records of the time that when the war and the independence began in 1919, that like, you know, a lot of the action was in rural Ireland. I mean, it began near where I'm from in Tipperary and Salehead Beg with Dan Breen and Sean Tracy and the lads. You know, that's and you kind of know from kind of like accounts that there's lots of rural people who joined the flying columns, who ran those flying columns. Now, from your kind of record, I mean, was there any division in terms of kind of like the farming classes when it came to the War of Independence?
Yeah, well, I suppose certainly in the run-up to the War of Independence, what you see are, it's almost considered to be, in certain counties, it's considered not to be appropriate for the better standing middle, upper middle class farmers to get involved in these political groups. So it's very much the labouring classes and the farmers' sons who tend to be classified as this different group. You know, the farmers are there, they're working the land, and the sons have a bit more time on their hands. They might be a bit more revolutionary and they get involved in political activities. Certainly when you look at where the volunteers are formed and how those volunteers develop, you get that development where you've got the farmers involved along the west coast, but in the good lands around Kilkenny and Tipperary, there's again these quotes saying that they don't want to have to engage with the lower classes, to drill with the lower classes and the Irish volunteers. Yeah. So we get that sense that particularly when we move on then towards the War of Independence, things change and it is a broader political movement. But the farmers are supportive by their actions rather than by actually participating in the flying columns themselves.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Okay, that's great. I mean, we've covered a lot of ground in terms of like being conditions on the farm during that particular period. Is there anything we've left out? Is there any other kind of like issue that would have had a big bearing on how they taught? And how,
yeah, I suppose land purchase is a big thing that's being discussed in this period, and we tend to think about land purchase as having tapered out with the 1881 Land Act, and that solved all the land purchase issues. And 60% of tenants do own their land by the time we get to 1911, but there's still 40% that don't. So land purchase is one of these big issues that they keep coming back to, and it causes huge tensions and, you know, develops into that political mobilisation. But the big thing to note about land purchase is it doesn't solve all the problems. So even where people do manage to buy their lands, they still have the same quantity of land to farm. So they're still making the same profits. So conditions at a local level don't really get a chance to operate as well as they might do if people had these larger farm holdings. And that's where land redistribution becomes a huge factor once we get into the Free State in the 1920s.
Yeah. And then one final question. Thank you very much for your time, Arlene. I really, really appreciate you coming along. It's great. It was great to find you. It's great to have you here. I'm curious about, like, you know, when the Free State kind of came into being then, you know, when, like, I suppose farmers had, like, in many ways, they'd solved the national questions. Were there still kind of issues around the graziers? Were there still issues around that particular class?
Yeah, I mean, land purchase doesn't really get sorted properly until the 1930s. Excuse me. So what we see is a real targeted attack on the remaining landlords, and there is an element of sectarianism, racism, for want of a better phrase, in the legislation that's passed by the early Free State, targeted predominantly at the remaining landlords and trying to dispossess them of any untenanted lands that they have, and the graziers also fall under that. So we see new land acts in the 1920s that address the remaining 20-30% of the land that hasn't been sold at that point. And the only way as a landlord that you can hold your property is if you turn it into ranch land or forestry land, or you're actually showing that you're actively farming it. So we see this is kind of where the horse industry in Kildare and Meath really develops into its own, because those kind of areas that are being used for horse racing and horse breeding are exempted from this legislation. So they make full benefit of that, and we can see that then beginning to develop.
Yeah. It's interesting as well when you refer to kind of like areas like Kilkenny and that, you know, that were kind of like, I suppose, they were stood offish when it came to kind of the War of Independence. They happen to be kind of strongholds for Fine Gael now.
Yeah, and there is that sense that, you know, there's certain countries or certain counties where it's more of an issue for the population, where you've got well-to-do large farmers where the economy's going fine, people tend to be less willing to engage in political activity. Where there's people that are suffering on the subsistence levels, farms, those are the people who are campaigning for change. So if there's not an active campaign there, then people tend to sit back. So it's crucial that we have that kind of, I suppose the legacy of the land agitation is crucial then into the national movement as we go into 1919, 1920, because it gives that background that lets people drive on from that kind of initial standpoint. And people are engaged in politics. They know what's happening because of that.
Okay, excellent. Arlene Cramsey, thank you a million for coming along.
Thanks,
Arlene Cramsey,
everybody.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Arlene for taking the time to join us at Banter, and thanks to Roz, Jimmy, Declan and all at Borbia for their help with Banter at Bloom. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to at Banter, plus you can also listen back to all the Bantercasts to date. Until then, goodbye and take care.